Welcome to the Udacity Thought Leader Series podcast. In this episode, Sebastian and Dr. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, discuss leadership principles, the future of artificial intelligence, and personalized learning.
It's my incredible delight to have with me, not just a close friend, Eric Schmidt, but my role model, my mentor.
Wow.
Perhaps the smartest person I ever met.
And I would say the same thing about you.
I mean, it would be true. I mean, I say it about you. Eric is a person who, just like me, grew up as a computer scientist. But unlike me, he understands technology and people and leveraged this throughout his career. He got a PhD at the wrong institution at Cal. I have no clue why he would do this. And then moved on various jobs, Sun Microsystems. Actually worked in the original Udacity building here in Latham Street for quite a while for General Magic. Became the CEO of Novell, then from 2001 to 2011, the CEO of a website, I forgot the name, something with a G, Google, and then moved on as chairman, and has been an incredible force here in the Valley. I think there's no one, really no one like you, who's been a technically strong person, but a great, great people here.
Well, thank you.
So welcome to the program.
You know, when I was a computer scientist at Berkeley, there was one place that had the smartest people in the world. It was the Stanford AI Lab.
I thought it was MIT.
At the time it was the Stanford AI Lab, called SAIL.
Yeah.
And when I met you and I realized you were in charge of it, I said, oh my God. And of course, what you did at Google with creating X and so forth will have enormous history. But what I like about your role now as an educator is you're leveraging your vision, right? And there's an age at which it's more important to get other people to do what you want than to do it yourself. You get so much more power.
You know, I completely agree. Actually, that age, I would say, just with my comment, starts any age, because if you leverage other people, you multiply your powers.
Yeah.
I always joke to my people, I'm only the guy who takes credit. I don't do any of the work here. Because all these wonderful people watching right now are doing all the hard work.
One of the secrets, by the way, is to be able to hire people who are as smart or smarter than yourself, and then make sure that they're comfortable, they like working for you, that you're supporting them. It works super well. An awful lot of executives forget that the way they can be successful is that the hiring is the best. Over and over again in my career, your ability to identify talent, literally by IQ, capability, work ethic, you know, whatever it is that you care about, seems to determine your success.
Yeah, I agree with this. Yeah, so you, I mean, let's dive straight in. You created this incredible culture at Google. You came in, I don't know how big the company was in 2001.
150 people.
150 people. I assume somewhat chaotic at the time, as every startup company. And you came in as the adult supervision, as you later said, and created this culture that is not just a good work ethic and do no harm, do no evil, but also all these other things, like the free food part and the massages and the outings that I was part of occasionally. What went through your mind? Why did you do this? Why didn't you just focus on work?
What's interesting was that a lot of those came from the vision of the founders, Larry Page, Sergey Brin. And they foresaw essentially graduate school on steroids. The experiences that they had at Stanford, which you were part of in your research, showed that you could have both incredibly smart people and fun and be incredibly productive. My job was to harness that into something that looked like a company. And so when I set out essentially to build the normal aspects of a company, the sales teams, the marketing teams, and so forth and so on. And I think you need both. When you found a company, when you lead a company, you get to set the standard, you get to set the tone, you get to set the humor and so forth, you get to set the ethics, obviously incredibly important. You get those trade-offs, and if you get the right combination of people, you get success. One of the things to remember when you start a company is that there's selection bias. There's a set of people who are looking for what you're offering, and there's a set of people who run away from it, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to get people that who are consistent with the values and the style that you set, and we did.
That's very true, and the values were amazing to the present day. But tell me the following. So now you have this graduate school environment, and typically a professor has like 10 graduate students, and they
sure.
do 10 different things. And now you hire 1,000 people. How do you prevent these 1,000 people doing 1,000 different things?
Well, partly is because you want some amount of creativity and you
right.
need to somehow keep it all together. When I started, we had 5 engineering managers who had been appointed by Larry and Sergey. And in the first few months, Larry and Sergey reviewed what they were doing and decided that they should get rid of all of them. And I said, well, that's very interesting. I've heard of many reorganizational structures, but getting rid of the entire management team was a bad idea. And what had happened was that they had been looking at what the engineers were doing versus what the managers thought they were doing. And they concluded that the managers weren't paying attention, which was the right analysis at the time, of course. So we did what was called the disorg. And the idea was that we would have roughly 120 people and one manager.
Wow, that must be
and
tricky.
I figured this will work great. These are all independent people. They're going to love it. They're not going to want any management. So we did this. And within a few months, all we had was complaints from the engineers who wanted management. And I said, why do you want management? Well, they didn't actually want to be told what to do. They wanted emotional support. They wanted professional support. They wanted group support. They had problems with other organizations. They wanted the managers to do that. So it was a good reminder that the job of a manager is to get their people to be productive, to figure out what their problems are and solve them. So that's what we put in place, and that worked.
That is totally true, because my manager that you assigned to me, Bill Curran, was exactly that way.
In fact, interestingly, that your manager, Bill Curran, was the person who was in charge of 100 people. This guaranteed he could not interfere. And Bill talks about it today as one of his favorite times, because he had this enormous sense of freedom, right? And ultimately, people said, we want more of you, not less of you.
Yes, it's interesting. When you ask managers, first-time managers, what's the role of a manager, they often say, oh, supervise, be informed, hold people accountable, meet with them once a week. And when you ask staff, they say the opposite.
So the key thing to understand is that if you have the right people, you don't need to manage them. I'll give you another example. So Larry and Sergey and I, one day, decided to fly to Omaha to visit with Warren Buffett. And famously, he has one floor of one building where he runs a multi-billion dollar corporation. And so we said to the Oracle of Omaha, how do you do it? And he said, it's very simple. I only buy companies where the company is going to do what I want to do without me. In other words, they're going to do what they're doing whether I'm present or not. I don't have to worry about them. I don't have to worry that they're going to show up. I don't have to worry that they care. In other words, I just know they're working hard. And I said, well, that's great. How do you find that? He said, you have to talk to them, right?
Yeah.
But I learned a lesson from Warren, which was, if the executive is passionate about what they're doing, they will sort the problems out.
And I think it's true for everybody in the company, all the way through every rank, right?
But this style that we're talking about is not the common style in corporations. And it has to be taught, because people somehow think that control is the way to power as opposed to influence.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Speaking about this, I want to go back in your life a little earlier and have this question I never asked you, which is, how do you make yourself so loved that your colleagues disassemble your office and reassemble it with a working telephone?
So in my case, when I was a young executive at Sun, I came in on April 1st, and my entire office had been removed. And there was a Volkswagen Beetle, right, the car, inside my office. And it had inside of the car, it had my office phone, because that was a mobile phone at the time. And they had carefully not put the gas tank in, because they were concerned that they might violate some building code rule. And I thought, this is pretty bizarre. So of course, this was on television and so forth. And I told them that if you could do all of this in 24 hours, why can't you ship the products even faster? But somehow it worked. And I think what I would tell you is we all felt like we were part of a team. We had a greater purpose in mind. We cared a lot about each other. And I loved the team. This was the team that originally built the predecessors of the operating systems that people use today.
Very nice. One thing I always enjoy with you is having a conversation about the future. And I think you are probably better connected, and now with some more free time on your hand, much more engaged in all the things happening in Silicon Valley. What shines for you right now? What's something you really pay attention to?
Well, it's worth debating what does the future hold. And if you ask people that, you get all these sort of, oh, you know, we hate this, or we don't like that, or we're upset about this political problem, or so forth. And that's sort of the normal complaining. But let's actually talk about what does the future look like. First, there's going to be more people, because people are living longer. And that's going to be true everywhere in the United States, but elsewhere. And by the way, they're going to spend even more time on their phones.
Right? Whether you like it or not.
So more people, more phones. Another thing that's going to be true is that the networks are going to be impossibly faster. we're going to go from 4G to 5G to 6G to 7G. And with the developments in telecommunications at the radio level, which you're very familiar with, the ability to do enormous amounts of bandwidth over the air, plus, of course, powerful fiber optics in the ground, we're going to have a surplus of communications, not a deficit of it. So when you start thinking about that, you think about, that's a pretty powerful platform. Now, if I told you that, I don't know, elections could be interfered with by governments, you'd say, not possible. But indeed, it happened. If I told you that there is concern that people are spending so much time online that we're changing their brains, you'd say, not possible. But it's happening. But it's happening. And we're just at the beginning of this transformation. Now, I'm a huge optimist about this, and I know you are as well, because the power of information, taking people who are information starved, either because they were poorly educated and so forth, and answering their curiosity and empowering them is the solution to the problems of the world. So with that communication, connectivity and knowledge comes all sorts of business opportunities and issues. Typical example would be there are these things called GANs, which are generative adversarial networks.
Right.
You understand these very well. And these GANs, indeed, thank you.
I think it's
one of, last time I checked, it was one of your most popular courses at Udacity. And the GANs enable you to do, for example, fake videos. Do you think that as a result, there'll be more fake videos in the world?
Of course.
No question. So what are we going to do about it?
You're going to learn about that they could be fake, just like news stories.
But what are we going to do about it? Are we going to ban them? Are we going to regulate them? I mean, these are important questions that the industry doesn't know how to solve. But I think it's fair to say that there will be more people, more health, more wellness. People will live longer. People will be more connected. They'll be using more apps. It's a pretty simple prediction. And I just want to say it because it's the foundation for your students, for your audience. It's the foundation for their jobs, their careers, their companies.
And right? The future of Silicon Valley.
Well, and the future of the world. And keep betting on that. The phone is not done. Cloud computing is not done. Now, one of the comments, I've been working on the question of when does this end? Mm-hmm. And you know, mainframe computing did end, personal computers did end in their current
kind
form.
Kind of morphed. Right?
Yeah, they morph. And I.
You can think of my phone as a terminal to my mainframe computer that happens to be distributed.
And I've been doing this long enough that I've actually seen the cycles. Right. So in 1997, I wrote a diagram which described cloud computing. So that was 20 years ago. In 1997, you worked on self-driving cars. Right, which are today still, hopefully soon, but still not quite with us. These things take a while. But nevertheless, it's clear to me that at some point Moore's Law will run out. And then what's going to happen, I don't think we know. An awful lot of people believe that quantum computing will then be strong enough and powerful enough to really give us a new computing platform. But I think we have 5 to 10 more years of not just Moore's Law, but also algorithmic improvements, specialized processors, and so forth. The party's not over yet.
Yeah,
not for another at least 5 years.
You said we could solve most of Americans' problems by moving away from fossil fuels into renewables. Explain.
Well, let's think about what the issues are that most people have. They want more jobs. They want more growth. They want more investment. They want successful businesses. And by the way, they need to address climate change. For the last 15 years, every year we've had hotter and hotter summers. I was just in Greenland. The rate of Greenland melting has accelerated. When this stuff is over, you're going to miss Florida, right? You're going to miss the Chesapeake Bay. You're going to miss most of Bangladesh. The level of impact of sea level rise alone in terms of humanity is enormously bad, right? And I'm not just talking about remediation. I'm talking about real harm to people, especially who are poor. So plus all the issues around biodiversity and changing the planet and accelerating changes. So one way to approach this is to say, I don't have to deal with it, people in the future. All of those strategies are the worst. The best strategy is for us to say, it's a real problem. As a country and as a business, we need to invest in it, right? And by investing it, we can make money doing it. Renewable fuels are now equal to or lower cost than new coal and new natural gas.
It's quite amazing.
Right?
Yeah. Phenomenal. About this.
It's absolutely phenomenal. And you know why? Because of innovation. Because people keep getting this. The cost of solar photovoltaics is declining at 8% a year at the moment. We have many, many other technologies coming along. There's reasons to think that if we put our entrepreneurial brains to it, and really start to address the business issues and what is called the valley of death, we can get through this.
Do you think you're going to get this at some point as a nation?
Well, so far the political will is not there. I think the science is clear. I think the business community is ready. And I think as a nation, we're going to have to face the fact that at some point we've got to focus ourselves on this. Politically, climate change is becoming more important, but it's still not as important as economic security.
Yeah.
What I hope we can demonstrate is that economic security, which is super important,
yes,
and jobs and investment and so forth, all go together.
Yeah.
Right? That's the goal.
Good. You and I spend a good amount of time talking about artificial intelligence for the last many years. In fact, you encouraged me to start Google Brain when deep learning wasn't a quantity, and that now has taken over good parts of Google. There's all these positive perspective and negative perspective, doomsday scenario, it's going to heal the world, destroy the world. Where do you come down?
Of the many things you've accomplished, the starting of Google Brain, which your audience probably doesn't know, was the one of the first spin-outs of Google X, has become the basis of the economic and technology growth within Google. And what Google Brain is it's the use of AI and machine learning techniques at a scale that's never been done before. And you use it every day when you use Google. Your answers are better, the intelligence and so forth are all better. This particular kind of learning, which is sort of traditional learning, looks like it's going to take over the entire industry. For every business problem, with a little bit of work, you can get better recommendations, better choices, better targeting, better economics. To me, the real question is what happens after that? What kind of general intelligence will be possible? My view is that AI will morph into something where we end up with question and answering that's very sophisticated. So you're a physicist, you have a question, you say to the computer, I want you to read all the articles. I have a theory that if I do an experiment over here, something will happen. And I want you to study all of the physics and make a prediction to me as to what will happen if I do this experiment before I decide to blow myself up. Now, you sit there and you go, that's insane. But in fact, it's soon to be achievable because the computer can really read all the documents, it can really collect all of the target information, and it can begin to sort it.
So your belief that natural language processing is absolutely core, the obvious missing link that today's AI cannot really understand books in any deep way.
But it's coming.
I think at the brink of this.
It's coming. And I'm not suggesting that this in any way replaces humans. In fact, the opposite. I think what will happen is people who are working with these systems will get higher wages. If you look in the digital transformation, people who worked in the analog world, so the people who worked in mechanical shops and so forth, got higher wages if they could work the CNC machine, which required some level of computer operation, something, again, you talk about at Udacity. What was interesting is an awful lot of the workforce were unprepared for that transition. That, in fact, it looked like you needed a college degree to operate these machines. So we have a problem that we need to come up with AI tools that the average human can use that makes the average human smarter, that is better targeted, quicker, so forth and so on. And I think that'll be strong. A lot of people run around with these arguments about somehow AI is going to eliminate jobs. I think that the evidence is that AI will make industries more efficient, the economy will grow, and there will be a shortage of people to fill the jobs that can operate these systems.
Yeah, you and I agree on this.
And I'll give you a simple example. The number one example that's always given is truck driving. After all, truck driving is a hugely important job in the United States. And what's going to happen when all those truck drivers lose their jobs? First, right now, the number one hardest position to fill in the country is truck drivers to drive the trucks because the economy has grown. So that argument's wrong. Furthermore, the drivers themselves do much more than drive the truck. They're part of security, they're part of loading, they're part of unloading, they're part of keeping the inventory, they're part of communicating. That function's not going away, right? So these scenarios are not going to happen.
Boy, I'm not speechless. I love your examples, how you put it about the future. And of course, you and I have written an opinion piece a while back.
Yes,
it was very successful. Positive in AI to counter the negative.
But what's interesting is we keep trying to explain this to people, and people keep doubting us. The core message here is that when you take humans and you make them smarter, things get better.
Off.
Right? I defy you to argue that making the average person smarter in any society is a bad thing.
That's a great way to put it.
And when I say smarter, I mean more effective, more capable of achieving their objectives, more critical in their thinking, more able to actually deliver on the things that they care about.
Well, Udacity has a huge number of commercial partners where we go into corporations and train people inside corporations, insurance companies, trucking companies, home improvement companies. If you were to run, say, a home improvement company that's 100 years old, should you be scared? What should you do?
Well, the first question I would ask, let's assume my business is going well in home improvement, which it would be in most of the economies that I've studied. The first question I would ask is, what is my vision for the next 5 years in terms of my workforce? Mm-hmm. And my guess is I would decide that I need more digital skills. And I would start by saying, where do I need digital skills? Well, I have some kind of inventory and operational problem. I have to move products around and so forth. So I need to improve that. But what I really need digital skills for is for merchandising, for advertising, for reaching people. Now, a simple rule is that young people today spend all their time on their phones. And so here you are, and you have some home improvement company, and the customers are walking by looking at their phones, not at you. What is your strategy to get on their phones? What is your strategy to become relevant to them? I'm not suggesting I know the answer, because I don't. But I'm suggesting that the business problem used to be one of ERP, MRP, which is sort of logistics and so forth. But now it's generating demand in a crowded market. And customers of our age behave differently than the next generation of customers. First rule of life. And so if I were running one of those businesses, I'd say to myself, I want a compelling story, which might mean ultimately something on Instagram, something on Snapchat, some way of getting to the customers getting to them as opposed to getting them come to you. Now, and that's a lot of digital skills. Virtually none of the companies I've spoken with have good answers to that question.
That's interesting. So do you think that companies will be replaced by new companies that have a different sales approach, different marketing, different business style, different staffing?
All sorts of people make this claim that somehow these digital companies will come along and they'll displace the existing customers. Mm-hmm. I think the answer is too simple of an answer. I think for some industries, which are relatively easy to displace, the new companies come in and they can, in fact, displace it. But in the vast majority of cases, the vast majority are going to end up with the incumbents with additional add-ons, whether the incumbent adds a digital group or whether they have digital partnerships. My general view is that most of the older companies, if I may say that in a blunt way, are not particularly good places to work for these digital skills people,
right,
but that there will be many, many small startups mm-hmm. who will be the experts in this, whether it's digital branding, digital marketing, get to your customers. I'll give you an example. I'm an investor in an AI startup that's trying to do essentially reinforcement analysis for people's data. And this is a niche company, which is super interesting, because these are proud companies that don't have that technology. I think we'll see that over and over again. As these tools get more specialized, you won't see broad diffusion of the tools for a long time, but you will see the creation of many startups that can do this.
Do you believe in the general artificial intelligence will overtake human thought?
A lot of people have been debating this question. So general artificial intelligence is roughly defined as
smart as people,
as the way humans can be creative. Right, yeah. As opposed to working on a single task, the ability literally to see a task, see another task, make an association, mm-hmm. and reason from that. So that's the generally accepted definition. And it's pretty clear to me that we'll get to things which look a lot like that, but it's not clear to me that we'll get to human level. We will clearly get to savant level. So I use the example of physicists. A biologist, a lawyer, right? It should be possible for computers to be infinitely smarter than a lawyer about the law and about physics than the physicist. But the moment you ask them a question that's not in their training base and not in anything that they've seen, their ability to manipulate to something completely different is unclear to me.
So you'd say we stay with specialized intelligence and the real true general artificial intelligence is not going to come?
If it does come, it will take a long time. Here's the argument for it. Computers today can see everything with natural language processing, they can organize all the concepts, and that over time they can develop all the objects and the concepts and they can learn all the relationships. And then proponents of this argument say that once you've organized all the concepts, using reinforcement learning and other techniques, it will be possible to then optimize to an outcome.
Yeah.
So you can see the relationship of this object and that object. The problem with this is that we are still in a situation where we cannot model the behavior of a 2 or 3 year old child using all of these tools. There's something about the human brain and the way it's built and connected which eludes us at that age, let alone our adult age. And until we understand that, it's going to be hard to see how taking all the blocks of knowledge and then using reinforcement learning and other techniques to generate the outcome will get at the level of depth of a human.
Yeah, I agree with you. Last question I'll ask you. Tell me some cool startup ideas that you have that you would love to do if you're 25 again.
Well, the two most interesting categories, in my view, have to do with information in general and biology. So in biology, what's happened is that the digitization of the analog world, the sort of lab world of biology, means that we're going to see an explosion in essentially synthetic biology of one kind or another. Whether it's drugs or treatments or or antidotes or however the problem can be phrased, it's clear to me that as the secrets of biology are unlocked at a digital scale, the tools that we use on the computer side will be applicable. There are many, many people who are now working on essentially categories of cells, how do cells work to each other, and so forth. This knowledge block, which is hugely important, will then enable this generation of new businesses with enormously positive effects for diseases and so forth. You're well aware of the positive impact of imaging on healthcare. Most doctors spend most time looking at you. I'd much rather have the computer look at me and then advise the doctor. Dermatology, retina, looking at my retina, looking at my skin, that sort of thing. That's all pretty obvious to me. I think there's huge businesses to be built there, let alone predicting hospital admission rates and things like that. Mm-hmm. In terms of generalized intelligence, to me the real question is that there's a race. And that race is on for the attention of the next generation. And I'm pretty convinced that the tools that we're all using now, which really derived from the 1990s, right? They originally started at Xerox PARC and so forth, are going to be replaced by very different user interfaces that I don't understand, which are much more attuned to how humans communicate. And these personalized devices, which we used to call phones, which are now your best friend, will somehow get you, and they'll be able to understand and anticipate what you want and make your lives more effective.
You see, we could do this today. We could start working on this today. Like, why does my phone wake me up in the middle of the night? It happened yesterday night.
But we're getting to the point where the tools are capable of that, and that should also be a very large number of new companies that come out of that.
I mean, you know that we worked together on Google Glass at Google.
Yes.
You obviously know about Magic Leap as a new headset device, which I have at home. It's beautiful. At least Google Glass didn't quite make it.
It was too early. But what's interesting about Google Glass was it was the right idea, right? Which is you have eyes, ears, nose. You have to get all that information in. I'm not suggesting I know what the user interface will be, but I'll tell you that the WIMP interface, as it's called, Windows Icons, Menus, and Pulldowns, which was invented in essentially the 1970s, is almost 50 years old. It's time for that interface to be retired and be retired to something which is much more human integrated.
I remember when we did Google X, we had this discussion about brain implants, and I literally declared, so you're crazy thinking that the next generation of cell phone require opening your skull. But it feels like something.
There's a really good Black Mirror episode on this.
Go for it.
Here's the problem. One way to think about evolution of technology is that if you stay in an information regime, you get extremely fast learning. You take all the data, you change your model, you build new companies, everything occurs very quickly. The moment you start dealing with human beings, in particular life-critical things, including drilling into your head, you are adding a decade of iteration. Things take very long, for good reasons.
Yes.
For very good reasons. So I think it's pretty clear that you have two speeds. You have this speed which is dramatic and incredible around information technology, where biology is beginning to be able to run at that speed. The finance world is beginning to run at that speed. But the things that involve human beings, for proper and good reasons, will be slow.
When will education go at that speed?
Well, this is a great question, because education should be possible to move as quickly. And you and I have talked at some level. It seems to me that with these technologies, it should be possible for you or a competitor of yours, if you choose not to do it, to build products which essentially figure out how one person learns And this notion of personalized learning, where you get it exactly right and you time it exactly right, is the future of education. It's obvious, right? There's so much training data. In my own philanthropy, I've been funding some projects to try to get the data public so that people could begin to use tools and build companies from that.
This is something we do right now in certain ways. We optimized for finishing rates and engagement numbers, but it is a long road forward.
And it's very hard. But let me tell you that, let's say that you had millions of student data about how they learn. And furthermore, you had it across every cohort and every age through public and private schools. And it was public with de-identified, so you didn't violate anybody's privacy. Can you imagine if you discovered that one-third of the students learn in 8-minute increments, one-third don't learn at all because somebody has to yell at them, and one-third learn on their own in a variable way? I'm just making that up.
That's then exactly what we have.
Honestly. Then you could build tools, right?
Yes.
It sounds like you're busy building them to do that. My goal would be to say, why don't we focus on the people who are underserved today? So there's plenty of people in rural areas where the teaching quality is poor, especially in the world. So think about, I'll use China as an example. You have enormous strength in the Chinese citizens, the Chinese cities. What about the rural areas? Pick India. You have enormous strength in Indian cities.
States.
What about in rural areas as well? What is true of everyone in those rural areas? They all have mobile phones. If that's not a business opportunity for you and everyone else, I don't know what is.
Eric, it's so great to have you over.
Of course. Call anytime, as
You're
always.
You're a wonderful friend. You've been a wonderful mentor in my life.
No, congratulations to you and Udacity.
It's an honor.
No, but look at the impact that Udacity has had. It's phenomenal.
We're trying our best. We have this amazing vision that education could be worldwide accessible to everybody.
Sign me up.
Absolutely. Thank you so much,
Thank
Eric.
Thank you, guys.